The Creative Music Guild, Merrillhurst University, and KBOO Community Radio are proud sponsors of a weekend residency by Mark Rabeau, May 8th and 9th at Merrillhurst University. Renowned guitarist and composer Mark Rabeau will perform a solo concert on Friday, May 8th at 8 p.m. and will lead a workshop on group-free improvisation on Saturday, May 9th from 2 to 5. The workshop is open to musicians of any experience level, and all instruments are welcome. Both events are taking place at the St. Anne's Church on the Merrillhurst campus, 17600 Pacific Highway, which is Highway 43. More information about the May 8th and 9th events featuring Mark Rabeau can be found on kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And it is a minute and a half past 10 a.m. on KBOO Portland. And as you heard, Air Cascadia is off today, and we will hear Between the Lines. So let's listen to that right now.
The nation has witnessed three incidents of grossly inappropriate police violence, which in two instances resulted in the death of unarmed African-American men. In an April 2nd sting operation gone wrong in Tulsa, Oklahoma, an untrained 73-year-old White Reserve Deputy Police Officer Robert Bates shot and killed suspected gun trafficker Eric Courtney Harris as he fled the scene of the undercover operation. Bates has since been charged with manslaughter. Several days later, on April 5th, Walter Scott, who was stopped in North Charleston, South Carolina for a broken taillight, was shot to death by white policeman Michael Slager as Scott ran away from the officer. Slager is charged with murder and has been fired by the police department. In another incident on April 9th, Francis Pusock, an unarmed white man who fled police officers serving a warrant, first in a car and then on horseback, was severely beaten by 10 San Bernardino, California sheriff's deputies after he had surrendered. The 10 deputies involved had been placed on paid administrative leave. The thing these incidents had in common is that they were all captured on video, either by a bystander, a police body camera, or in the case of the beating in San Bernardino, a film crew in a news helicopter. Without the irrefutable documentation seen in the video images, it's likely that police accounts of these events may have been accepted by investigators at face value, and officers guilty of misconduct may have suffered no consequences and escaped all accountability. In the Walter Scott case, it's clear that the report written by Officer Slager immediately after the shooting contradicted the facts later seen in the video recording. Your reporter spoke with Matthew Fogg, a retired Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal, who won the largest ever $4 million employee Title VII discrimination lawsuit against the U.S. Department of Justice. Here he examines the culture of impunity that exists in some police departments that leads to irresponsible acts of violence without consequences.
So it is a culture. It is a culture that has been in place. And yes, only because we're seeing it now on these cell phone cameras and video is capturing it, is this new technology today that law enforcement wasn't expecting to expose them. But that blue wall of silence, they have been doing this to people for years. This is a everyday occurrence. And if you could see the numbers of people that have been actually shot, even taking records, like we've been saying, there should be a federal record on how many people, every shooting that police involved in should go into a database. You would be shocked. This is just the tip of the iceberg.
Matthew Fogg, maybe you could speak to what is it about the police culture in your own experience that would lead some police officers to believe that they are unaccountable to the public for their behavior, and that certainly there are many instances where this is proven out. You also have many folks in the police department who, by their very actions, appear to believe that they are above the law.
Right, that's correct. Police departments, that whole paradigm is like military. It's command and control structure, so it's so goes the top management, there goes the bottom subordinates. And what happens is power corrupts. I mean, you put a badge and a gun on somebody and you tell them that, you know, you got unbridled authority, especially when you start talking about minority communities, black communities, people who can't really fight back, people whose voice is not really considered legitimate. If you go make a complaint, we all know if that incident that occurred in South Carolina or the one out there in L.A. or the recent shootings up and the killing of Eric Garner in New York and on, and Michael Brown, if these incidents weren't brought out to the public the way they were, wouldn't nobody be saying anything about them? It would just be their word against the citizens' word, and especially that incident in South Carolina where they just completely lied on all the reports. I'm telling you, I have seen it with my own eyes. It's a common, it is a common, as much as the public may not want to believe it. And now, I think like Ray Kelly is a good example. Ray Kelly, the former commissioner for the New York Police Department, he recently, after the incident in South Carolina, he changed his mind. He was thinking that body cameras sort of invade the privacy of the police and so forth. So, man, you know, I always said you don't have privacy. It's body cameras protect even good cops. It protects everybody because now the public has an opportunity to see exactly what we're doing. But now he changed his mind. He said, you know, he said, after seeing what happened in South Carolina, I am now a believer that body cameras need to be issued to officers. So it's a culture that I think it gets out of control. You have to have a civilian review board. You can't let the police themselves. Just like this country has, you know, the executive body, the judicial body, the three branches of government, to sort of checks and balances, you have to have that same thing for police department. You can't let us just go unbridled because it will get out of control like it is.
Matthew, I wanted to ask you, what are the most effective tools, do you think, to improve police-community relations? Is it more intensive training, established police community review boards, mandate independent investigations of allegations of police violence, and or utilizing body cameras? What, in your view, right, is the most useful here?
I think all of the above. I mean, body cameras, definitely civilian review boards with subpoena power and separate prosecutorial investigative power and authority. You have to have that because you're given law. I tell people say, well, it's just a few bad apples. I said, listen, you can't have a few bad apples in law enforcement. I said, that's like telling me in the room there's just a couple of terrorists in this room. I said, you got to have zero tolerance in law enforcement because they can change or alter someone's life at the drop of a dime. I said, you know, if you was in a stadium and somebody came over the bullhorn and said, look, we got 100,000 people here. Everybody's, for the most part, a good, but we got two bad cops, and we don't know what they might do. Everybody's going to go home because the bottom line is you don't know when you're going to run into that person. So you can't have, in law enforcement, a few bad apples. It has to be zero tolerance. And I've said that all in my career, and that's what happened to me. Them same guys that took me through the changes that I went through ended up leaving me on a stakeout. Other things occurred with other people. You can't have racism in law enforcement. You can't have gender discrimination. You can't have any forms of federal or local or violations of the law in law enforcement. Because if you do, it throws the whole paradigm off.
That was Matthew Fogg, a retired Chief Deputy U.S. Marshal, who won the largest ever $4 million employee Title VII discrimination lawsuit against the U.S. Department of Justice. Find more news and commentary on police violence and accountability by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. 48 Yale University undergraduate students with the group Fossil Free Yale conducted a sit-in on April 9th outside Yale's president's office. The action was organized to pressure the university to reconsider its decision not to divest fossil fuel stocks from its $24 billion endowment portfolio. At the end of the day, 19 of the students were arrested for refusing to leave the building. Yale now joins Swarthmore College students who have conducted a sit-in since March 19th, Harvard, which launched what it calls Heat Week civil disobedience actions beginning April 12th, and other universities and colleges across the U.S., which are now stepping up protests to press for divestment this spring. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with several of the Yale student activists before they began their building occupation. We first hear from Chelsea Watson, a sophomore.
The way we started this campaign was we would solely work through administrative channels. We didn't do very much movement building. We were really focused on like research, proposals, meeting with administration. And after doing that for about 2 years, getting a no before me, and then getting a no this August, it's become clear that any work that we're doing, the administration is not paying attention. The administration has closed the conversation. Every time that we elicit a response, we've gotten a few responses. We're only given sustainability initiatives. I work for sustainability. I love sustainability, but the thing is that that's a separate thing from divestment. Sustainability focuses on our Yale campus's individual carbon footprint. It focuses on Yale students' carbon footprint, but it doesn't focus on the scope and scale of climate change.
Next, freshman Maya Jenkins responds to the criticism that divestment is not an effective strategy.
Divestment, a lot of the arguments is that it won't actually financially injure any companies, and it's critical to understand that divestment does not seek to financially injure any companies. We know that our school divesting is not going to crash the market, but what it does seek to do is kind of change the conversation and stigmatize these industries. And so it's, you know, it's a political statement more than anything, and I think especially at a place like Yale with a lot of clout, and Yale has been a leader in numerous things, divesting would help to change and shift that conversation.
Sophomore Nathan Lobel explains that the students' initial ask was very modest, to request that any companies represented in Yale's portfolio that are among the top 200 corporations with the largest fossil fuel holdings publicly disclose the amount of carbon and energy produced by their fossil fuels each year, and to divest over 5 years from companies that refuse to disclose that.
Well, Yale is fairly unusual in that we actually have a document called the Ethical Investor that governs how the university is supposed to behave in this situation. So last year, we designed a divestment proposal that was purposefully exactly within the lines of divestment through that document. And even with all of that compromise, the Yale Corporation decided in August that they were not going to divest, and not even going to do the most basic part of that proposal, which was to ask companies to disclose how much carbon the burning of their fuels was producing. After that time, we decided that if the corporation wasn't going to work collaboratively with us, we should be advocating for everything that we want when it comes to divestment. So that proposal focused very heavily on the social injury of climate change, where really the social injury that fossil fuel companies inflict is definitely largely environmental, but also includes various social injustices, which include the fact that the victims of climate change, the first victims of climate change, are always going to be marginalized communities, people of color, citizens of developing nations, indigenous communities. But also even just in their extraction and refinement processes, the fossil fuel industry inflicts a social injury on these groups. When you see water that's contaminated from fracking, when you see the people displaced by mountaintop removal coal, again, those are always the same types of marginalized groups. And the people who are the victims of those social injuries are never really the people who look like the decision makers at a place like Yale or in a boardroom of an oil company.
For Between the Lines, I'm Melinda Tuhus.
Find more news on the fossil fuel divestment campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 6th annual Abortion Access Bowl-a-thon on Sunday, April 25th at 4 p.m. at Interstate Lanes in Portland. 12 registered bowl-a-thon teams will be bowling to raise funds for the Network for Reproductive Options Abortion Fund to help make reproductive rights a reality for those who can't afford to pay for an abortion. Again, that's the Abortion Access Bowl-a-thon, Saturday, April 25th, 4 to 6 p.m. at Interstate Lanes, 6049 North Interstate in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
We bowl away our daily cares with little strikes and little spares.
And today on Locust Focus, we're going to hear an encore show about tropical deforestation with host Barbara Bernstein, and the guest will be Deborah Lawrence. So do stay tuned for that on your community radio, KBOO.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
And by Volunteers of America, Oregon, presenting a symposium on diversity, equity, and economic stability, May 8 at the Child Center. Keynote speaker, Stedman Graham,